Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheck. Each day, when we look at stories about politics, international affairs, finance and the economy, and even entertainment, we tend to see disparate stories happening at a rapid digital pace in an integrated global landscape. For some observers, though, there's a unique ability to connect the dots, to see how many of these events are related, connected, and even manipulated in ways that benefit the few at the expense of the many. One of those keen observers is our own Russ Baker, the founder and editor-in-chief of whowhatwhy.org. We're going to spend some time with Russ today talking about these events. We're going to spend some time with Russ today talking about these connections and how it impacts Who, What, Why's coverage of the current election campaign and news in general. Russ, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. As you look around the world today at the politics that are going on here in the U.S., as crazy as they are, some of the international stories that Who, What, Why has been covering, talk a little bit about how you see connections between all of this. And certainly we see it in the way the public is reacting throughout the world, getting kind of fed up with what's been going on.
Sure. Well, let me give an example from this morning where I was reading about Goldman Sachs' settlement with the federal government over its involvement in the financial crisis of 2007-2008. What struck me was how this is the really gets at the core of what the politics are about this year. Basically, the bottom line is that Goldman Sachs, which held out longer than any of these other institutions that negotiated a penalty with the federal government, has gotten by far the best deal. They're receiving all kinds of, although they ostensibly have to pay a large fine, and that's what goes out in the press releases. If you actually look at it carefully, what they're paying, in fact, is much, much less because they're being given all sorts of tax credits and other benefits in return for this deal. Now, what this is about is really the anger of the American people, which we see certainly in the Bernie Sanders supporters, but we also see it in the Donald Trump supporters, and I think we see it in a lot of them. I think a lot of the Cruz supporters are angry. I'm sure some of Hillary Clinton's supporters are angry. But look at these other factors here. Hillary Clinton doesn't want to release the speech that she gave for money to the very same Goldman Sachs. Huge amounts of money being donated either directly or through super PACs to the candidates through Goldman Sachs and outfits like it. We see them basically admitting to criminal behavior that they knew perfectly well that they were selling rotten goods to investors that everybody was in collusion, that the people who issued the mortgages knew that the people they were enticing to own a home couldn't afford to own a home. All the way down the chain, there was criminality. And then we see that poor people, particularly people of color, for example, go to jail for almost anything. We see poor people of all kinds, working class people of all kinds, struggling, paying a lot in taxes. They can't get the kinds of credits that Goldman Sachs gets. They can't cut deals that are advantageous to them. And so everybody's angry. Everybody, I think, to some extent, understands that the system is rigged. But how that plays out really, I think, defines our presidential politics. So, for example, the Bernie Sanders supporters, there's more of a direct appeal that the system is dirty and we need to shut these people down. The Hillary Clinton supporters kind of get it, but they don't feel comfortable with Sanders. They feel more comfortable with Hillary Clinton, or perhaps they're more focused on getting a woman into the White House or something else. I think the reasons that they support her tend to be a little bit amorphous. And I want to bring up another issue, which is about her foreign policy experience, which is being touted as one of her main assets. The Trump supporters are angry. They lash out. That's more of that nativist thing. They lash out at people who look different from them, and they think that these are the people who are hurting them. A lot of it comes down to how much information people have, how educated they are in how the system works, how much attention they pay to these kinds of stories, the nuances, more complicated sorts of things. And that, I think, is what direction people are sent in terms of the candidates that they back.
We're seeing this play out on a global landscape as well with the recent release of these Panama Papers and starting to see anger with certainly what happened in Iceland and what happened yesterday in terms of the reaction to David Cameron in the UK. I mean, we're seeing bits of this throughout the world.
That's right. Now, of course, one of the questions that some people are asking is, why are we not hearing about Americans parking their money offshore? I think it's too early to tell. There have been mentions that in these millions of pages that are held by this consortium of journalists, there will be material on Americans forthcoming. I was struck in the past when there were tiny little leaks of this sort, when information came out about Americans who were involved with offshore tax evasion, that they tended to be people we hadn't heard of before, if you will, almost bit players. Mm-hmm. And so one wonders, well, what are the super rich in this country doing? Are they not sheltering their income as well? Well, of course they are, and that gets into a whole other subject of how they do it. And I think part of it is just the fact that our tax structure in this country is already so advantageous that they're able to pay very little taxes even to begin with, and so maybe they don't need to go to these lengths and risk this kind of criminal behavior. But in terms of the people who are being focused on, clearly the biggest of all the names out there is that of Vladimir Putin. And although he is not directly involved, we've seen articles pointing to this friend of his, who the cellist, who somehow seems to have earned some improbably vast sum of money and parked it offshore. Putin, of course, says it's not really his money. In all probability, it is, just as it is with all of these, or many of these leaders. I think no country is immune to leaders enriching themselves. Certainly the Clintons have become very, very wealthy legally since they left office. And so that Panama Papers story is very, very important. It's important to remember that Putin is an enemy of the United States establishment, very much so. He's a threat to a lot of the more imperial designs of the United States. The Prime Minister of Iceland, certainly not a country that is lockstep with the United States at all. Cameron is a little more complicated. I think we have to take a closer look at that and see what it might mean that he could be in trouble or perhaps take a fall. This is just beginning to evolve, and we don't know where it's going to go. It strikes me in some ways as a little bit of a distraction because, like Watergate and other things, everybody gets all worked up and there's a tremendous amount of fulmination. But in the end, if you ask people, what is this really about, they have trouble explaining. And of course, what it's really about is that the rich are tremendously advantaged. They are advised to keep as much of their wealth as they possibly can through any of many means, and they take advantage of it. And there is this sort of constant battle, supposedly, between the authorities and the rich in trying to make them pay their fair share, which is related in part to the tremendous benefits they accrue from the services of all these governments that they don't want to pay. But the problem, of course, is that the government regulators are the same people negotiating with, say, Goldman Sachs. There's a revolving door. They themselves go to jobs in those same companies, and that is the size of the bread that is buttered.
You mentioned Iceland, for example, a small country, not a major player, and yet it was also a place that was very much at the center of the global financial crisis that impacted us in 2008, 2009. These places, these people show up over and over again. And people may not understand credit default swaps, and they may not understand derivatives, but they certainly do understand that something is going on and that, as you say, people are enriching themselves from it.
Well, that's right. And two excellent points you made there. I want to talk briefly about Iceland and also about the credit default swaps. Yes, Iceland is a complicated place. It's a tiny place. I mean, really tiny. The population of Iceland is smaller than that of Staten Island. Yes, it was absolutely one of the first to fail in this sort of chain of dominoes. One can argue that in many ways Iceland was more of a victim than anything else, but it's interesting how so much attention can be focused on a small place and not the commensurately larger attention that should be focused on some of the larger places. Also, Iceland politics tend to be, if you will, quite left. This is a place that was one of the birthing grounds of WikiLeaks, and it has members of its parliament who are very influential Greens and so forth. It's an unusual country. It's very, very progressive. And when anything bad happens to Iceland, I always pause for a moment. In terms of the credit default swaps and what was really going on with the crash, it is complicated, but in a nutshell, and I think it's important, and we do that, I think, pretty well at Who, What, Why, to try to boil these very complicated things down to be as clear as possible about overall what was going on. I think it's an important service to the public that the media doesn't provide often enough, and so I just want to make the point that what we're looking at is that these companies like Countrywide that were not that well known kind of came out of nowhere. I personally remember, and I'm sure you do, these advertisements constantly saying everybody should own their home. You remember that? Everybody should own their home. And I was thinking, well, why should everybody own their home? I mean, if you go to other countries, particularly the Western countries and Europe and so forth, many people do not own their own homes. Many people live in apartments. Many people rent. There are all kinds of issues involved. And, of course, home ownership, while it's a nice thing, it also is extremely costly, not just to the people themselves, but to the whole society. Los Angeles, the story behind the movie Chinatown, where their entire transit system was destroyed in part by these real estate interests that wanted people to buy land further and further out. That meant that they had to buy cars and so forth, and this benefited, of course, the petroleum industry as well. So there are often very great costs to homeownership, to society, and we never had a conversation about that, because in this country we're always touting these sort of unquestioned values, this is good, this is good, this is good, growth is always good, more is always good, bigger is always good. And of course, in the era of climate change, that's not a realistic way to think anymore. But in any case, the core thing was this basically fleecing people who didn't have enough income flow to service the debt on their homes. These are the same people who've been victimized again and again and again over the years, told to buy everything on credit, refrigerators, things that they could not afford. They were told that they were not whole human beings unless they owned these things. And so that's the background to all of it. It began with that, and then these companies that were making the loans, they knew that these people couldn't pay, and so that was criminal right there. And then what they did was they said, we've got to unload these loans because we're not going to get paid back. And they turned to the entities like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Bank of America and so on. They said, listen, how about we sell you these loans at a considerable discount and you can do what you want with them? And then they were able to wash their hands. It would be interesting to see the accounting on what they still made after they discounted these things. But in any case, they sold them to these banks, and then the banks took them and packaged them, and then issued bonds to the unwary, again to the public, a different public, but still to the public, and said, "Hey, look, the credit rating agencies," and here's the third criminal element here, says that these things are just, you know, smack dab terrific. They're really, really solid. You ought to buy these bonds, and we'll give you a good deal. And so they're basically one entity after another, criminal behavior, and they are passing it all off to the sucker, which is the average American. Well, come full circle to the elections this year, no wonder people are mad. No wonder most of us are struggling, and despite the supposed good economy, don't feel that it's good at all.
It's interesting that we go back to the 2008 election, 2012. In many ways, those were about recovering from the damage from the financial crisis. This really seems to be the first opportunity where people get to look back at really what happened. Why did it happen? How did it happen? All the points that you were just talking about. And they're beginning to see that, well, it's wonderful that to some extent there's been some recovery. There's a price we've paid for that, and it's one that is not helpful to the vast majority of Americans and a lot of people throughout the world.
Well, that's right. And, of course, with that kind of situation comes, number one, all of the damage that has been done to many Americans from which they've never recovered, whether it was the loss of their homes, the loss of their jobs, the loss of pensions, retirements, of a secure future, all kinds of benefits that they had, health and otherwise. And so the entire society is destabilized. But more than that, we can look and see that the people who were the criminals in this basically came out okay. And I don't see enough attention paid to that. You know, even Sanders doesn't focus so much on that end. He's got his mantra, which is, you know, really just a few lines repeated over and over. But it is this piece of it. You know, who are these people? I mean, I don't see the media, for example, identifying the criminals. You know, why is it that we know who killed one person or who robbed, you know, one store, but we don't know who robbed the whole store and who killed the dreams of a whole country? You know, what I would love to do, Jeff, is as Who What Why grows, and of course we need more, we need money too, we need funding from the public, we don't want to take it from the Goldman Sachs of the world, but as we grow, I would love to see us cover the criminals, the big criminals, and put their names out there and their pictures and the story, because it's not okay to be criminal. It's not okay to lack ethics and morality and to victimize your fellow citizens.
Are we perhaps at some kind of a tipping point, some kind of an inflection point in terms of the public waking up to realizing some of the things that we're talking about?
I hope so. Sometimes it feels that way. Certainly, if we look at a lot of these issues and the underlying premise of all of our discussion that, you know, greed and selfishness and power lust drives almost everything in the public discussion, or drives a lot of the negative news. You know, I would hope that we're seeing some kind of a change. We've been talking about this thing for years at Who What Why. We've been doing stories about the wars and the stress, overstress on terrorism and panicking people, disinformation and so on, and how all of this feeds and benefits certain corporate agendas. And I think people are a little bit waking up and starting to understand that they're getting pieces of this thing. They see the Panama Papers and they're at least briefly outraged. Some people with the Occupy Wall Street movement, certainly the Snowden revelations, WikiLeaks, there have been any number of things, and obviously the economic collapse, where people see that there is something wrong. Whether the public will take the next step, which is to really educate themselves so they understand what is going on and why, and whether they will take the step after that, which is to do something about it, really is what remains to be seen.
Do you see it as a generational shift also when you look at the readers and the comments and the people that talk to you about the things and the stories and who, what, why? Are you seeing a generational shift here?
I do see a generational shift. Our readership is fairly diverse demographically, but overall, I would say, I was just looking at the polls for New York State and have Hillary Clinton way ahead. She's most the group where she's furthest ahead of Bernie Sanders is among African Americans. The second group that she's most ahead in is with elderly people, and then the third group is women. And that's quite interesting because Sanders is winning among young people. He's also faring better among men. But this is very interesting because if you were to go and you were to actually do a civics test, a quiz of the people in the poll, I think there is no question that not all elements of society are equally aware of the kind of things that we're talking about. I mean, it's sad to say, but the audience right now for the kind of things that we're talking about tend to be well-educated, younger, largely white audience. And, you know, if you look at African Americans, and then this is in part just because they are still very much economically struggling and in other ways and beset by an unfair criminal justice system, there's so much crisis and turbulence in the lives of a large share of our urban and also rural black population that, you know, getting through the day is difficult enough. There really isn't a lot of time to kind of be, you know, reading The Atlantic or PBS or listening to PBS or something like that. And that's just a reality that is not discussed. Now, with elderly people, somewhat set in their ways, you know, worried a little bit about change, and even though in some ways perhaps Bernie Sanders is more of a vigorous advocate on protecting their Social Security and other benefits and things, I think they are a little scared, and they're a little worried in responding to the notion that, you know, maybe he is not as experienced as she is, and that's that reaction. With women, it's understandable. There's never been a woman president, and that's important to them. And, you know, as today is the day that they use today as an, I wouldn't call it a holiday at all, but it's a day that is demarked for drawing attention to pay inequity, mm-hmm. that women have to work 4 extra days out of the year to earn the same as 4 extra months out of the year to earn the same as a man earns in a year. And so these are understandable things, and I think they're hoping that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, we will see greater equality. I'm not sure that that will necessarily follow, just as I think that electing an African American as president didn't necessarily really benefit African Americans.
And talk a little bit finally about how Who What Why is covering this election and really the things that you want to focus on in the coming months.
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the handicaps we faced was what I talked about earlier, just a lack of resources. You know, obviously you've got to pay your writers and your editors, so we haven't been able to do what I would like to do. I consider Who What Why to be an aspirational project. That means that what you see on the site are examples of the kind of things we like to do, that we'd like to do more of, more stories, more frequently on more subjects, going deeper. But what we have done, and I think we've certainly put out enough stories giving our audience a sense of what we think is important, is to not follow the pack, not to participate in the sort of beauty contest, horse race aspects of who's up and who's down, who has done a better job of acting on the public stage, who has done a better job of, you know, hiring the right people and running the right ads. You know, it's not that that's not interesting, but that's that kind of inside baseball stuff that really doesn't have a lot to do with the choice itself. And Who What Why emphasizes, I think, that what really matters is the choice itself. Right now, there's a discussion between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders about who is more qualified, who is more experienced. Well, what does the word qualified mean, and if we are to look at qualifications, what are those qualifications, and how do they actually play out? How, if somebody says they're more qualified, what does that mean? What do they do? And, you know, certainly, for example, in the case of Hillary Clinton, I don't mean to unduly pick on her, but I mean she is the front runner, both on the Democratic side and overall to be the next president. You know, they talk about her experience, that she was Secretary of State, and yet we see that Jimmy Carter, a revered peacemaker, says that Hillary Clinton did nothing to advance peace when she was Secretary of State. I mean, that's a very harsh critique. And so I think that what Who, What, Why is doing is we're looking at the stories, we're trying to find the diamonds in the rough, the things that are buried that really matter. We're looking at things like the disenfranchisement of voters. We've been doing a lot of stories about the democracy process itself. Is there, or should we be worried about things ranging from electronic voting without a proper paper audit trail to whether or not certain elected officials are helping candidates that they favor and creating obstacles in the path of voters that they do not want to vote. So I think you see on Who, What, Why those kinds of forensic digs, soil samples, if you will, on the state, the health of the democracy itself.
Russ Baker, whowhatwhy.org. Russ, thanks so much for spending some time and sharing some of your thoughts with the listeners.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.